to have some film and some visuals and whatnot, but we haven't, so in the true punk style, we'll just carry on regardless and not give a monkeys. Okay, so my name is Nick Welsh. My colleague, esteemed colleague Nick Hughes, and I were talking after the death of Malcolm McLaren, I suppose 3 years ago now, we were talking about, well, we were playing Duck Rock, Malcolm McLaren's kind of seminal early 80s, I suppose, album. And we were talking about, Nick and I are the same age, and in 1976, we were eight, so we were out riding our bikes and climbing trees and trying to kiss the girls and all that kind of stuff. So we completely missed it. We didn't have any kind of real knowledge of what punk was, or although I had older brothers, so I kind of got a bit of an inkling of who the Sex Pistols were, but it wasn't until much later that I kind of discovered all that for myself. And so Nick and I were talking about this, and I'm a designer, Nick's a designer, and we were kind of talking how the aesthetic, not just the aesthetic actually, but the kind of ethos of punk informs what we do as creatives, as designers now. And we had this idea to have this thing at Greenbelt. We weren't quite sure what it was going to be, but it ended up, I knew I'd quite like Willie to be involved because I've known Willie for a while, and we've often talked about his journey from kind of, which he'll explain in a minute, from kind of 76 onwards when he left school. And then I suppose back in May or June, Paul from the Greenbelt office emailed me and said, look, don't tell anyone, but Don Letts has agreed to come and play. So I thought, well, we'll have him, because he was there in more ways than one. So, Don, can I turn to you first? So 1976, where were you? What were you doing? And just give us a little bit of a kind of background.
76. Let's try this. I'm trying to condense it. Okay. The mid to late 70s were pretty gloomy times in the UK. We're talking about massive recessions, strikes, high unemployment, and as the Pistol so eloquently put it, a general feeling of no future. And this was particularly obvious amongst my white friends. I mean, the music of the time had become so removed from their day-to-day experience that it was no longer a soundtrack for their life. So popular culture had managed to alienate its own white youth. Me being first-generation black and British, I was alienated from the get-go. But luckily I had something to soothe my pain, which was reggae, and the music and the messages that I got from that. My white mates weren't so lucky. You know, there was things like, I don't know, Hotel California, and these guys didn't know where California was, much less being able to afford a hotel. So basically, my white friend set about creating a soundtrack that was relevant to their situation, and that was punk rock.
So how old were you in 1976 when this all kind of kicked off?
20.
Okay, that's quite a cool age to be in 1976.
20. I'm as old as rock and roll. I was born in 1956.
And what were you doing?
What was I doing? I was working in a shop on the King's Road, Chelsea, which doesn't sound that exciting, but back in those days, these were the places that kind of the dispossessed and disenchanted youth met. And my shop was called Acme Attractions. Malcolm McLaren had another shop further down the road called Sex. And these disaffected youth would wander between my shop and Malcolm's shop and invariably spent more time in my shop because I had a better soundtrack. I'd play reggae. And you could buy a pair of trousers in my shop for 20 quid. In Malcolm's shop, they were 60 quid.
Willie, 1976.
Just doing my O-levels and not having a clue. Did quite well at school, but didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. And because that's what you do, apply to go to university. But even up north, I was just explaining to Don that you have to sort of put your watch back 18 months. In those days. And we were reading about what was going on down in London. I'll never forget, the first thing I saw was probably the NME or something, and there was a story about this thing called punk rock and these punk clubs and how these women would get, you know, very made up and everything, they put their fishnet stockings on, and then get a bin liner, a bin bag, which they would wear as a dress. And, of course, we looked at this and thought it was the most hilarious thing we'd ever seen. And you couldn't hear the music. That was the thing. I mean, it's probably hard enough in London, but certainly in Yorkshire, there were, you know, the radio stations weren't playing it or anything like that. And the first time, it was actually my fifth year, you know, after the O-levels, leaving Do, where some cheesy nightclub in the centre of Sheffield, the DJ had a copy of Anarchy in the UK. And basically announced it, saying, this is what you've been hearing about. And, of course, then you hear this noise, which is just this clarion call. And it all sounded terribly interesting. So I then applied to go to university in London because I thought, if I'm going to go to university, I may as well go where there's something happening. And happily, by the time it came to actually go, I'd run away and joined the circus, so I never actually made it. But I was living in London, so I moved down to London. And it was terribly exciting. And I think the coincidence of that happening just as I was at the point in life of thinking what do I want to do was a remarkable gift, really.
Could I mean, for both of you, how much did you read Punk as a Manifesto? So, for instance, Don, you picked up a Super 8, and Willie, did you pick up a strip light or something?
I think people got to understand that, you know, back in the late 70s, punk was portrayed as this kind of negative, nihilistic, hateful movement, and it was never about that. It was about empowerment, individuality, and freedom. And to get those messages in your formative years was extremely important, because this came at a time when schools trying to turn you into a model citizen. And for those of us that were smarter than the average bear, you knew there was something else out there. And invariably that came to me through music and, to an extent, cinema. Mm.
Cheers. Willie?
I think also, just like anything, I guess, at the time, it's only in hindsight that it really looks like a movement.
Yeah.
Where this was a sort of a day-by-day and a blow-by-blow thing. And it was funny because, again, listening to it, when Nick asked me about this, I dug out all the 7-inch singles I have from that period. And it is hilarious because some of them, like... I have Pretty Vacant, which still sounds as extraordinary as it did then. But other things, the first punk single I ever bought was Do Anything You Want to Do, Eddie and the Hot Rods, right? Which now sounds like the Ronettes, only slightly faster. But at the time, I guess there wasn't I didn't have the critical faculties to tell the difference. So it's really in hindsight, I think it looked like a movement. But all I knew was that there was this music and these people doing these things which I just thought were fantastic. And
I mean, I think the most important thing to come out of that whole movement was the DIY ethic, yeah. Do it yourself. Mm. I mean, that's still an ethos that serves me on a day-to-day basis. And that whole movement was about young people trying to create a soundtrack that was relevant to their lives. And for the most part, it was about how are we going to live. And I guess, furthermore, how are we going to do it together? Mm. You know, it wasn't about the mohawks and the safety pins.
Yeah. Just before we move on, I've actually realised that I haven't introduced Willie and Don. But I just want to say, people, you do know who these two people are, right? They don't need an introduction. No?
Good. Sorry, okay. I don't know I'll who move I am on. Either.
So. I was going to, picking up from what Don was saying about a sort of, and also actually William Gibson, the cyberpunk novelist, has said about Willie that he kind of has a low-tech joy. And it's picking up on this idea of like making do, using what's around you, and putting it to a purpose. In terms of both your practice, I mean, and Don, you're about to kind of talk more about that, and I know, Willie, you kind of got some fantastic kind of simultaneously high tech, but they are contraptions. If you'd like to both talk a bit about that.
So. Well, in later life, as Nick said, the thing that I've really enjoyed is because I love all the technology, absolutely love it, and the fact that you can make movies in your bedroom and everything is really great. But it's certainly in context of shows, very technologically based shows, I found get cold very quickly and become quite impersonal. And also, of course, anybody can do it. There's no point.
Well, anybody thinks they can do it.
Well,
fine distinction.
Yes, and you can put anybody in that same situation. Whereas what I've always loved is taking all of that, which is great, but also finding a really handmade aesthetic to balance it. And like on Zoo TV, where that was the first sort of big high-tech video show, but the lighting system was made of Trabant cars from East Germany. So that you get this wonderful balance of the two things. And that's still fast. I mean, my little light show over the way there, is a good example of the handmade in contrast to the high-tech.
I guess for me, how I don't know, I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question properly, but when the whole DIY thing kicked off and all my white mates are picking up guitars, and you know, I wanted to pick up something too, but I looked at the stage and it was kind of full up. But through my interest in film, I thought, well, okay, I can't pick up a guitar, I'll pick up a Super 8 camera. And literally, with using the DIY ethos of punk, reinvented myself as a filmmaker. I mean, there's this thing about, you know, they used to say that whenever the Pistols or the Clash played in any city across the UK, the next day 100 new bands would start, which was partially true, but also there are a lot of people that took that inspiration and that information and it informed whatever they did. So you got people reinventing themselves as filmmakers, photographers, dress designers, graphic artists. And I think that's why that last incarnation of punk has had such a lasting effect, as it wasn't just a soundtrack. It was very much soundtrack. It was very much a complete subculture.
Yeah, and for me, the ethos was that anybody can do anything, and without having to have any qualification, or at least anybody can have a go. Yeah. And you soon find out.
Yeah, you did need a good idea, because that did come back to bite us in the posterior.
What did you mean lack of ideas?
Sorry?
Do you mean lack of ideas came to back to bite you in the posterior?
Well, let's leap forward to the 21st century. I mean, you know, I'm a great believer in putting the means of production in the hands of the people. Yeah. Not my idea, somebody else's. But I think that's turned around to bite us in the arse, because the downside of affordable technology, I think, is mediocrity. I do think that just because you can afford it doesn't really mean you can do it. You do need a good idea. But the facilities are there now that if you do have an idea, you can execute them. And that's what affordable technology has done.
Well, and possibly the fact that punk happened when it did, when England was in a bit of a state, there was always something to say. Whereas I think part of the problem now is there's nothing really...
Ooh, be careful.
Well, no, I mean, in the comfortable, the people you're talking about, the comfortable sort of middle class world of...
They feel like there's nothing to say.
Of X Factor and Facebook and everything.
It's an interesting, you've taken us down. I mean, you know, in today's cultural climate, particularly in the West, I mean, it feels to me like punk never happened.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
You know, and I mean, luckily I do get to travel a bit, and I realise that there are still places in the world that don't aspire to be on MTV and all the rest of it, and they still see music as a kind of tool for social change. I mean, it does have that possibility. It made me who I am today. You know, I grew up on music that helped me to be all I can be. You know, it's more about changing minds than changing your sneakers. You know, and I think a lot of the music coming out of the West has become like a soundtrack for consumerism.
Yeah.
And I think the young people need to reclaim that. It's their voice.
Don, I want to talk about The Clash for obvious reasons. Tell us...
What would they be? I'm joking.
Tell us how you met them, the Roxy, all that stuff. Just give us a little bit of a potted history in a few minutes of how that all happened and your journey
I'll
with
tell you
them.
What I will do.
And your journey with them up to now.
What I'd like to try and do is avoid kind of interesting stories from the past and try and make them relevant to where we are today. And what was interesting about me making connection with The Clash is that we grew closer by understanding our differences. You know, it's through culture and art, you know, through them liking reggae and me liking reggae and me liking what they did, that we actually, became closer. And that was when I began to see the potential of culture to unite the people. And I think that was what was interesting about our meeting. And it was tremendously empowering for me, because no longer was I the poor cousin, you know, being black and British, the alien. I had something to bring to the party, and that was, as a young person, tremendously empowering for me. And I still think that dynamic's relevant today. Does that make sense?
Yeah, complete sense.
Yeah. And then...
You don't look convinced.
Well, I just... No, I am convinced. I'm just wondering... You say you brought something to the party. I mean, obviously, you're making films and...
Not those days. I mean, that was when I first met The Clash. You know, I mean, what I'm saying when I had something to bring to the party, I mean, you know, the influence of black culture and white music's always been there. But if you didn't know anything about music, you'd be hard to join, to find the connection between Robert Johnson and Led Zeppelin. With The Clash, I could hear them playing reggae bass lines. I could hear them singing about subjects that I could relate to. And no longer did I have to try and work out my part in the equation with a code book. It was right up front. And like I say, really important to a young, confused man growing up in the UK.
And so, Willie, kind of Greenbelt and 1976, which you've spoken about here before, so we don't need to cover that necessarily now, but kind of Stiff Little Fingers I wanted to just briefly talk to you about, because they were kind of there early on, and how did that all come about and ultimately work?
Well, I was working with lots of different bands, basically just doing lighting, because that was what there was in those days. And a lot of the bands are very short-lived. And so one thing would lead to another. And, of course, it was a terribly social time anyway. And literally you meet people at motorway services in the middle of the night. And if they look remotely interesting, you just go and talk to them and say, who are you then? And they'd say, oh, we're, you know, X-Ray Specs or something. And so one thing came to another. I ended up working with Stiff Little Fingers for about a year and a half. And I mean, they were actually sort of at the end of their incarnation then. And actually what was interesting is they were very... Jake Burns certainly was getting very interested in reggae rather than... He could see that the punk sound was kind of dying a death, so looking around musically for other things. But then eventually they split up, so I found another Irish band to work for. But thinking of it at the time, it didn't seem like a series of great revelations. It was just the obvious thing to do.
Hindsight is, you know,
yeah,
you can...
Absolutely.
And then your work now, how do you, both of you, think, and you've touched on it a little bit, how does the ethos of punk influence what you do in various projects today?
I still use my punk ethos and ethic on a day-to-day basis. I still believe in turning what would be a problem into an asset. I still believe that a good idea attempted is better than a bad idea perfected, and there's lots of those around. And, I still believe that, you know, it's about using what you got to get what you need without hurting anybody else. And that's... I mean, the thing about punk rock, people have got to understand, it's really important, this, is there is this overemphasis on this late 70s incarnation of what, after all, is an ongoing attitude. I mean, this attitude and this spirit, it has dynamics, it has tradition, it has heritage. And this overemphasis on this late 70s thing, you know, mohawks and safety pins, it trivializes a bigger idea. And the bigger idea is that, as I said, it is an ongoing dynamic. And if you're brave enough and if you've got a good idea, you can be part of this as well. You know, if you're 20 now or 15 or whatever or 30, you ain't missed anything. The only people too young for punk are people in their diapers. You know, if anything, you could be too old for punk, because if you haven't got it by now, maybe you never will. But I think it's very important the young people understand that, you know, the punk attitude is, it's their birthright. And if they've got a good idea and they've got a good, and they're motivated, they can be part of this ongoing dynamic. It's not this dead thing that happened in the 70s. You know, the birth of the hippie movement was a punk rock moment. And what we rebelled against in the late 70s wasn't that image of the girl putting a flower down the barrel of a gun. It was against, we were rebelling against what the hippie movement had become, which was Cheech and Chong. Does anybody know who Cheech and Chong is? And it's interesting, because I think we're in a similar kind of climate now, where the soundtrack has removed itself from the people, it's become self-indulgent, it's become about selling product, keeping you stupid, because let's face it, the industry is not here to enlighten the people. You know, it's easier to take stupid people's money. What I don't understand is how in this climate we haven't had some response, some backlash to this cult of celebrity. I don't understand. I'm a little bit confused about that. But I think it's very important that we don't write off punk as this isolated moment that happened in the late 70s. It's like the Force in Star Wars, man. You can't stop it. You might just have to look in different places.
Could I pick up on that, on something that you said? I think, and you've said this in your biography about in a movie you wanted to bring in Marcel Duchamp, and I think a producer said to you, "What band is he in?"
Yeah.
And which
I did. He's referring to a movie I did about 5 years ago called Punk Attitude, and the sole purpose of that film was to give this dead thing legs and to show people that it is an ongoing dynamic. And yes, I did try in the film to give them examples of what I thought were punk, like Sun Ra, Marcel Duchamp, the films of Buñuel or whatever, and they were like, nah, just keep it simple, you know.
And Willie, your work now, how is kind of what went before influence you in your current life?
Well, obviously, the work that you do, or the work that one does, comes from the sum total of your life experiences. So it would be hard to pinpoint that exactly. But certainly this lack of fear of just getting up and doing something is very much with me still. Most projects I go into, if I thought about it for too long, I'd be too terrified to do it. Whereas all you have to do is look back and see, well, look, I've survived this long, so I guess I'll make a go of it again. But the historical thing is really interesting, and it's allowed me to start looking backwards and seeing it, particularly in Dada and things like that, seeing where this thing came from. Because, of course, we all grow up thinking that, you know, kissing had only just been invented and all the things you grow up with started with you. And so it was useful to look back.
So I just want to pull you up because it's an interesting moment to reintroduce Malcolm McLaren, because it was me meeting him in, like, the early 70s, like 3 years before punk rock. And, you know, like you said, you think that, you know, you're the beginning and the end of everything. And it was Malcolm that helped me to join the countercultural and subcultural dots to put it in some kind of ongoing dynamic. Yeah. And it was him that really made me realize that it's not an isolated moment.
No.
You know, you're part of this ongoing thing.
Yeah, and I suppose then you think about what you can do for
what you can do to be part of it and justify your space and how you can infect your immediate environment. That's what punk's about. Yeah. Forget the mohawks, forget the safety pins. I've got to tell you this, I've got to throw this in the mix. You know, it's not even the preserve of the artists and the musicians. And in fact, I'd go as far as to say that in the West, that's the last place you're going to find the punk attitude. Because, you know, any kind of any radical idea or social thoughts, that's all been castrated. Because, you know, like I say, they want to create this soundtrack that sells product and kind of disconnects you from the planet and the politics and the people. So I think that it's important that people understand this is an attitude that can manifest itself in all walks of life. I don't even know if we need any more goddamn musicians. Position's kind of full up, you know what I mean? But, you know, you can have, you know, we could do with some more punk rock teachers and some punk rock doctors. You know, whatever. It's important. It's not just about music. Really important.
Can I?
Sorry about that.
Just added to that. I mean, and joining the dots is a lovely way of sort of expressing it. You can kind of trace this on sort of broken line from Marcel Duchamp through various sort of interventions through sort of William Burroughs, the cut-ups, various things, and it goes through, and even right, if you keep on going up through, you know, you go through DIY culture, you go through rave culture, you go through that sort of like the repetitive beats phase when sort of under the Thatcher government, but then you keep on going, and even up to now with Hackers and Anonymous and Lulzsec, you know, you still have that sort of spirit or ethos.
I was going to say you might well, you know, find much more punk attitude on things like the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, WikiLeaks, things like that too. And it's a double-edged sword because at the same time, you know, from the inside, the punk thing wasn't frightening or dangerous. But if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, it could be very dangerous. And I suppose with the tools that are available now, something like WikiLeaks, which on one level changes everything, in the wrong hands is still dangerous.
We're going to have some questions. If you've got a question for Don or Willie, we haven't got another mic, have we? Or should we just...
I think there's a mic down here on the left.
Is there? Okay. If you want to... Has anyone got a question? Or actually, you could probably just shout it out. Actually.
Shout!
Anyone?
Shout.
Hi.
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I mean, what happened to punk rock is what happens to all underground movements. It eventually becomes part of popular culture. And the truth be told, punk rock got really stupid really quickly. You know, within about a year and a half, it was nonsense. I think the moment that kind of sealed its fate was Pistols on Bill Grundy. I don't know if any of you know what I'm talking about. Pistols went on the show, and they started swearing and spitting. And all of a sudden, the next day, the whole country thought they knew what punk rock was about. Wrong. And at that moment, a lot of the more intelligent people kind of moved away from that first wave of music and started what I guess was the post-punk movement, which I think is a lot more interesting than the initial punk explosion anyway. You know, for an example of that, you might look at the difference between The Clash's first album and London Calling, or The Pistols' first album and anything that Public Image did. But I'm losing my point. This thing where the underground becomes the overground is an ongoing... It's like light and dark, like Star Wars. It's an ongoing battle, you know what I mean? And the man kind of decides to buy into it. You know, Marilyn Manson does something really... I'm trying to censor my language here, which is very difficult.
Please don't.
You're amongst friends. Difficult. I wouldn't worry too much about it.
You know, but basically you can co-opt rebellion and market it the next week. So it's an ongoing struggle of young people constantly trying to reclaim their voice. I'm not sure if I answered what you...
Any other questions? Gentleman at the front. Just shout really loud.
Yeah, they jump on it. Jump on it, squash it, castrate it, and then put it in a box and sell it. That's right. Yeah, that process is happening quicker and quicker these days. I'll tell you what's interesting about that dynamic that's always been there, is in the old days you could sort of point your finger at the man or the system or whatever. But I think in the 21st century, there's a complicit guilt where when people are offered the choice of doing something that's slightly edgy or radical or might make you think, they kind of opt for the soft option. And I think that's a new disturbing element that's happened in the 21st century, that offered the choice between something that's going to make you some money or make the world a better place, people take the soft option. And I think we have to look at our part in that equation.
Who are the artists, filmmakers, musicians, both of you now, who you think, not necessarily are punks, but have that working ethos today?
Well, I suppose one, and this picks up on people who are, and not that this is unkind, but not people who are easily corrupted, would be Michael Moore, who went in, I mean, Roger and Me, which is his sort of breakthrough movie, was really all guns blazing. And obviously Bowling for Columbine and things like that, where he was just able to just chase people and just go for it. But then he, of course, becomes a celebrity, and I'm not quite sure where you go from there. But, I mean, that was... He had an impressive start, anyway.
Don?
Peter Griffin. And Family Guy. Is my mic on? It's good timing. Sorry. One, two.
There you go.
Punk rock. Yeah, Family Guy. Yeah.
The cartoon.
Yeah.
Go on.
That's the only place I see punk rock in the West at the moment. It's Family Guy. If you're easily offended, don't go there. That's all I can tell you.
Are there any more questions out there? I did see a few more hands.
Yeah, he did.
I think that really colored back from the meeting because it really looked like it was just as much constructive as anything else.
Listen, Malcolm McLaren was a long way from perfect, and he was all the things that everyone says about him. But in the midst of that, the good outweighed the bad is all I can tell you. He once told me that nice people don't have good ideas. Not really true, but in his instance, it definitely worked.
Any other questions?
I want to go back to the point that Dom made earlier.
Uh-oh.
Now you're in trouble.
But obviously the Clash of Punk was really important for me, especially for Two Tone, were really important.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I don't think it's possible to come out of the West anymore, because one, they'll either jump on it really quickly or you won't get through the door. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, I can only relate to, I mean, do you know guys know who Puff Daddy and Snoop Dogg is, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I was a promoter and I put on Chuck D and Gil Scott-Heron in this venue and I put on Snoop Dogg and Puff Daddy in that venue, which one would sell out? Yeah, the rubbish one. Now, whose fault is that? You know, is that the man's fault? Or this is what I'm saying. We have to look at our part in the equation. And, you know, the truth of the matter is a lot of the music coming out of the West is just to sell your product, man. You know, it's really disturbing because I do believe in music as a tool for social change. It made me who I am today, and I get to travel around the world and I see that it still has that possibility.
But don't we just think that because we're old?
No, what are you talking about? Who's old? No, listen, I'm 55 and 56 and loving it. And as I said to you, you know...
There must be when something
you,
out there,
no, when you get to travel and you see, you know, there are places that aren't aspiring to be, you know, MTV and all this red carpet nonsense. And there are still people that believe in the power of music to communicate ideas. It wasn't just about entertainment. You know, it has a role to play in society. You know, people in the West forget that, you know, music isn't something that the kids do. You know, my culture is an integral part of my culture. And it is that for a lot of people on this planet.
A good friend and mentor of mine, Steve Fairney, who's no longer with us, he's a very funny man, but he had a great phrase. He was about the same age as Don, and had a great phrase that Margaret Thatcher abolished hobbies. And he grew up through the 60s and was used to, when he was growing up, the fact that people would do things just for the love of doing them. This is a great idea. Let's see if we can do that. Whereas, as I say, his take on it that was through the 80s, the mindset totally changed, and you grew up with, or the kids grew up with, this idea that if anything didn't make money, then it didn't really have any value. And that's exactly what you were saying, where given the choice of doing something that could change the world or something that makes money. And I think it's more than just... that the forms run out of ideas. It's actually this mindset that everyone grows up with. And I find it myself now in some ways. I mean, I do a lot of work in the performing arts world, which I said yesterday is a euphemism for unpaid. Yeah. But people like that I find incredibly inspiring, the Kronos Quartet, Laurie Anderson people, who still have that sense of just wanting to do something because it could be extraordinary. And I think with you know, the youth of today, etc., the fact that they're growing up in an environment where if something doesn't make money, it doesn't have value, that's really a huge problem, I think.
Do you think...
You actually feel a bit stupid doing something if it doesn't make money. Or I think that's a danger. You know?
Actually don't believe there's anything wrong with getting paid for a good idea. I think that's a bit of a con as well. I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with making a living from having a good idea. It's just at what cost.
Yes, as long as it's a good idea.
Yeah. And the idea is good.
Absolutely.
I was just going back to what you said about kind of Thatcher, you know, and do you think, and I'm being a little bit facetious, but do you think Tory governments breed...
More riots.
Wasn't what I was going to say, but yeah, okay. Breed, I was going to say good art, but I'm not quite sure what I mean by that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, hard time, as a
reaction to what's going on.
Well, the best
politically.
Art is supposed to come out of the worst. Yeah, yeah, he did. Listen, Malcolm McLaren was a long way from perfect, and he was all the things that everyone says about him. But in the midst of that, the good outweighed the bad is all I can tell you. He once told me that nice people don't have good ideas. Not really true, but in his instance, it definitely worked.
Any other questions? Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I don't think it's possible to come out of the West anymore, because one, they'll either jump on it really quickly or you won't get through the door. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, I can only relate to, I mean, do you know guys know who Puff Daddy and Snoop Dogg is, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I was a promoter and I put on Chuck D and Gil Scott-Heron in this venue and I put on Snoop Dogg and Puff Daddy in that venue, which one would sell out? Yeah, the rubbish one. Now, whose fault is that? You know, is that the man's fault? Or this is what I'm saying. We have to look at our part in the equation. And, you know, the truth of the matter is a lot of the music coming out of the West is just to sell your product, man. You know, it's really disturbing, because I do believe in music as a tool for social change. It made me who I am today, and I get to travel around the world and I see that it still has that possibility.
But don't we just think that because we're old?
No, what are you talking about? Who's old? No, listen, I'm 55 and 56 and loving it. And as I said to you, you know...
There must be something out there,
no? When you get to travel and you see, you know, there are places that aren't aspiring to be, MTV and all this red carpet nonsense. And there are still people that believe in the power of music to communicate ideas. It wasn't just about entertainment. You know, it has a role to play in society. People in the West forget that, you know, music isn't something that the kids do. You know, my culture is an integral part of my culture. And it is that for a lot of people on this planet.
A good friend and mentor of mine, Steve Fanny, who's no longer with us, he's a very funny man, but he had a great phrase. He was about the same age as Don, and had a great phrase that Margaret Thatcher abolished hobbies. And he grew up through the 60s and was used to, when he was growing up, the fact that people would do things just for the love of doing them. This is a great idea. Let's see if we can do that. Whereas, as I say, his take on it, that was through the 80s, the mindset totally changed, and you grew up with, or the kids grew up with, this idea that if anything didn't make money, then it didn't really have any value. And that's exactly what you were saying, where given the choice of doing something that could change the world or something that makes money. And I think it's more than just... that the forms run out of ideas. It's actually this mindset that everyone grows up with. And I find it myself now in some ways. I do a lot of work in the performing arts world, which I said yesterday is a euphemism for unpaid. Yeah. But people like that I find incredibly inspiring, the Kronos Quartet, Laurie Anderson people, who still have that sense of just wanting to do something because it could be extraordinary. And I think with the youth of today, etc., the fact that they're growing up in an environment where if something doesn't make money, it doesn't have value, that's really a huge problem, I think.
Do you think...
You actually feel a bit stupid doing something if it doesn't make money. Or I think that's a danger. You know?
I actually don't believe there's anything wrong with getting paid for a good idea. I think that's a bit of a con as well. I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with making a living from having a good idea. It's just at what cost?
Yes, as long as it's a good idea.
Yeah. And the idea is good, absolutely.
I was just going back to what you said about kind of Thatcher, you know, and do you think, and I'm being a little bit facetious, but do you think Tory governments breed...
More riots?
Wasn't what I was going to say, but yeah, okay. Breed, I was going to say good art, but I'm not quite sure what I mean by that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, hard times, as a
reaction to what's going on.
The best art is supposed to come out of the worst times. Whoops, what happened there, eh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're standing by.
Stand by, yeah. Hold your breath.
Okay, next question. Gentleman with the red tie at the front. Just stand up and just really shout.
Yeah, but there's the internet and there's all these other ways to get information now. There's not a lot of excuse for ignorance. which is disturbing to me because a lot of these riots that I've just seen happening, were really disturbing because what I saw was a lot of ignorance, people fighting and not knowing what they're fighting for. I mean, I'm not going to get behind any riot that's trying to get a pair of sneakers.
It's a shame we haven't got the visuals working. There's a fantastic image. It's kind of a seminal image of which is ended up on the front of Super Black Market Clash of you, which actually until I didn't know it was you for a long time, but that image of that whole bank of policemen and then this Rasta guy kind of. I know you don't want to tell
lone,
loads of
lone fool.
I know you don't want to tell loads of stories from the old days, but just explain that.
One lone fool appears to be walking towards them. Truth of the matter is, what that camera does not show is that in front of me there's like thousands of cops, but what the camera doesn't show is behind me there's thousands of brothers with bricks and bottles. And the truth be told, I was getting out of the way. I've got to be honest, I was getting out of the way.
I'm sure you know the image I'm talking about. It's a.
You can Google it.
Yeah, Google it. We did. Yeah, Mike.
It's interesting, this whole technology, I think what you're talking about, the wealth of information and all that stuff, I think you said it's a double-edged sword, this technology stuff. You know, fundamentally it's a good idea, but then if you look at what most people are doing with Twitter and Facebook, you know, it's pretty self-indulgent. But then you look at things like the Arab Rising, and if it wasn't for Facebook and Twitter, we might not know half of the stuff that was going on. I mean, basically the bottom line is technology is great and people are crap. That's the bottom line. You know, the technology's not bad, it's what we do with it that's a problem.
Next question. Gentleman with a beard. Yep. Oh, you haven't got a beard. Okay, you first, and then the gentleman with the glasses and the beard. Go on. No, go on, you first. And your question is, sorry, pardon?
A lie is radical.
I'm glad glad it's your question for you, not me.
Yeah. Well, I think it depends how you define the terms conservative and Christian, really. But
yeah, I'm scared to say anything. Guess I'm
go ahead.
Go on, go for it.
I mean, I don't know about Christian conservatism, but in the West, conservatism generally is a problem. You know, I think if you look at art, it has become very conservative. It's no longer that radical, and it's kind of treading water. And that's why I think right now the West is not that interesting to me, and I do tend to look in other places. I don't know if that answers this question at all, but I'm...
The other chap with the beard and the glasses.
That's wrong. That's why I couldn't answer it. It was a statement, not a question. We've all got problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's fantastic to hear, really, is all I can say. And jazz is far more punk than punk anyway, so everyone knows that. So.
There's a hand behind this pillar. Which way was that? Is that the hand or is that... Sorry.
Oh, man.
Don, is punk a religion?
Oh, man.
You don't have to know.
I was only joking. You don't have to answer that.
Yeah, because if I gave my answer to that, you'd all be offended.
Oh, I hope so.
From my experience, religion's not that great. It's not all it's cracked up to be.
Yes.
All right, see, I shouldn't have said that because I'm going to get battered.
No, it's fine.
You're asking the wrong dude. 11 o'clock. I didn't know it. Yeah. Listen, I've got to level with you guys. Until yesterday, I didn't realize what this festival was about. I'll be quite honest. So I'm just trying to find my own bearings within this setup myself. Even more amazed to find out it's been going since 1974. You know, because I've had to think about it.
Okay, let me ask you this.
Publicity's never been that
had
strong.
Had you read... that invitation properly.
I'll tell you what I read.
No, seriously.
Obviously not. What I read was, Don, do you want to turn some people on with some music?
Yeah.
And I was like, festival? A little bit of money? Tick. And I was there. Yesterday, somebody told me, I thought they were pulling my leg. I have to be honest.
What did they say?
They said, you realise it's a Christian festival. And I was like, should I think about that? And I was like, no, they're people. And then I looked at my record collection and thought about some of the lyrics and went, no, I do need to consider that a bit. And out. Having said that, I do not play anything that's sexist, homophobic, or hateful, from my perception, in any manner. And that's my own censorship. And there's a lot of that around in music, I've got to tell you.
We've probably got time for just a couple more. There's a guy with a grey hoodie just at the top here.
Can we have Mr. Thornton as well down there?
Oh, Andy Thornton, he can ask a question. But chap up here with a hoodie.
I was just thinking that
maybe
social
networks
are a bigger problem.
Yeah, maybe,
actually.
It's a good idea of mine you had. Sorry, dude. But you're right. You're absolutely right that it does have a point. It does have a purpose and a place. It's just unfortunate that a lot of it does get abused. But, you know, the idea of people communicating with each other obviously is a fundamentally good idea. You know, you just need to have something to say.
Yeah.
Andy Thornton.
Yeah.
No matter how much energy you use, the jelly will absorb it. Even
Yeah, but what else are we going to do? We can't throw the towel in. I think, you know, I'm quite into banging my head against the wall and work towards a change I won't live to see. What else are we going to do? Last question, isn't it? That's massive,
well,
guy.
Maybe just say. What
I mean,
would,
look. I don't know about pushing
like
the system.
Happen,
I think maybe talking to the guy next door is a good start, though. Yeah. You know, I think maybe we have to think about it in realistic ways of things that are actually achievable. And yeah, the world. You know, is. I've got an 18-year-old son and a 17-year-old daughter, and they're like, "Dad, it's overwhelming." You know, because of that, they don't really get involved. But I think, you know, it's small steps, man. It's working towards something that none of us will see manifest. But what else are we going to do? That's my answer.
So Don played this afternoon in the Big Top. I've long been a Clash fan and a reggae fan and a dub fan. And I've been coming to Greenbelt for many, many years. And there was... it was 90 minutes of kind of, for me, worlds kind of colliding, and it was great to have you here. I'm so pleased you didn't bother to read the email invitation properly, because I'm wondering with.
I would have come anyway.
Well, I'm really thrilled that you did, and Willie, always a pleasure to have you here. Nick, anything you want to just finish off with, and then we probably should stop.
That's the rules.
Yeah. How much time have we got, actually?
I don't know. Where's
I think
the?
We got a bit longer.
But have we got a bit longer?
Yeah.
Oh, have we? So, have we got 10 minutes? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Oh, okay. So, well, we'll keep going
then.
We
do have more questions. So.
Any more questions? You've had one. Anyone who hasn't had a question, and then we can come back to someone who has. Chap at the front.
Oh, I'm open, man. Anybody who buys me a ticket, I'm open. If it's got palm tree, even better. But you know, I'm lucky enough in the DJ capacity to be in places like India and Australia and New Zealand and just anywhere that isn't smothered with MTV, really. Mm. You know, the world's a big and beautiful place, and it's got a lot to offer. And I think we just have to, you know, it's like these kids that are rioting. I mean, it seems to me that their whole world ends at the bottom of their street. And with all this media and stuff we're talking about, there's no excuse for that kind of ignorance anymore, you know. Get up and get involved.
Look, they're getting up and getting involved. They're doing it now. chap at the front.
Not that I feel you always have to be consistent, but you made a comment dismissing being self-indulgent.
What was that? Me? Is it me? That was you, Geezer.
Mm.
Is that consistent?
The question is, are hobbies self-indulgent? It would depend on the hobby, I suppose, really. But I think the difference between a hobby and being self-indulgent is one that you do at home and one you do in front of other people, probably.
Fishing you can't do at home.
But is fishing... Fishing's not self-indulgent, is it?
No, it's a hobby.
Exactly. So fishing not self-indulgent, that's a good one.
Isn't the thing about a hobby is... doing something that's not about making money, something you just enjoy?
Absolutely, and you love it. And
so what's the question?
I don't know what the
question is. Is a hobby self-indulgent?
No, sorry, that was my question.
Okay.
But I take your point that I was saying that we lost a lot when the sort of zeitgeist moved away from doing things that you enjoy just for the sake of it.
And everyone was trying to become an entrepreneur.
But
absolutely.
But at the same time, I did dismiss being self-indulgent, so...
Don, what's next for you? What's your
Man,
autumn
listen,
look
I
like?
Have no idea. Like many of the rest of you, you know, I spend my time hustling. You know, when you're doing stuff that's slightly left of centre, you don't get the offers that you think you'd get. I mean, I'm hustling. I mean, it's a slightly glamorous hustle, but, you know, I'm still sort of... I've got a radio show on Six Music. I'm still making films. I'm still out there DJing, obviously, and I've just recently been playing with my band Big Audio Dynamite. And it's a sum total of all these things that helps me to keep my head above the water.
Yeah. Willie, what about you? What are you up to?
The same. I'm just
I'm not complaining. I just want to add, I'm not complaining. I never forget that to be able to make any kind of living doing something you enjoy is a real privilege. You know, I watch the news every day religiously to see the hand that most people are dealt on this planet, and that keeps me grounded, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And likewise, you know, I mean, the life I've had is such a huge privilege. And I'm just going to keep on. I've obviously just finished this U2 thing, which went on for the last 150 years. So I'm enjoying a bit of...
A bit of R&R,
but also time to look at other things and things. The hobbies, basically.
Donald Etz, Willie Williams, thank you very much. So thanks for coming. That was great. Thank you very much.